Because I've had some technical difficulties this morning with my Zoom, as I related when I first got on the call. But thank you for joining us this morning. I'm going to go ahead and get started since it's 9:15, and we have some articles to discuss. So let's see, these are March's articles, and there were 17 original articles relevant to the purposes of this journal club that I identified in the journals that are sent for review. Additionally, there were 21 reviews, case reports, and letters, 13 of which came from Virchow. So it was a heavy thoracic month for us, and we were well represented. My summary only includes the discussion articles and the other original articles. I did not, given the number of cases, provide small summaries of the reviews or case reports, so my apologies for that, though all of those articles are located in our shared folder. So we've selected four articles for discussion today. The first will be presented by Rachel, our fellow. The other three that I've selected, I hope you find relevant for current hot topics, and are kind of those in which I think may be relevant to your daily practice. So before moving on to those, I'd like to briefly touch on a couple of articles for notation. Under the neoplastic lung disease, there were three articles, all published in Lung Cancer, that emphasize the impact of tumor-associated immune microenvironment in various types of lung cancers. Now, I don't see, you know, a tremendous prevailing theme. There are some themes, such as CD8 lymphocytes, but I don't see anything that may change our reporting of lung cancers at this time. But I think it's something to be aware of, because in the future, this may change the way that we report our lung cancers. So keeping it on our radar. Something else that under the neoplastic category, there was an article out of the Japanese group, again published in Lung Cancer, that was about EMT phenotype in the setting of tumor spread through airspace. This group looked at 635 lung resections for non-small cell lung cancers. I'm on page 11 if you want to see my summary. And they just looked at markers of EMT. Those that they selected were E-cadherin, vimentin, and beta-catenin. I'm just drawing your attention to this because they found that a mesenchymal phenotype, as they call it, that is E-cadherin negative and vimentin positive tumors that had spread through airspaces, was found to be an independent predictor for high risk of recurrence. So again, something to keep on your radar should in the future we be asked ever to start performing immunostains for risk assessment in patients that are found to have STAS. And of course, Rachel's going to be talking more on that topic in our first article for discussion. Moving on to non-neoplastic lung disease. The first article is out of Italy. This was published in Virchow's, and really it's showing that there's this growing interest in fibrosing DAD as a consequence of what happens to COVID patients who have severe disease. Of course, this is an autopsy study. The case that I'm going to be presenting as the second article for discussion is an autopsy study as well, but I think it just highlights the growing interest in what happens to COVID patients. And lastly, there were two articles, one published in American Journal of Clinical Pathology and another in Virchow's, both COVID-related papers looking at platelets and megakaryocytes in the lung. I think just speaking to the interest of thrombotic events that occur in COVID patients, and kind of perhaps not surprisingly, these studies came out of it. Nothing there that I think is going to change the way in which we look at COVID cases or assess or report them, but just some items of interest there. With that, I'm going to go ahead and be quiet and let Rachel present our first case, which she has selected and prepared herself. So Rachel, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. I'm going to try to share my screen. Let me know if you guys can see that. Is everyone seeing that okay?
Thanks, yeah.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. So my name is Rachel. I'm the pulmonary pathology fellow at University of Michigan. I'm going to talk about this paper by Han et al., which is called Tumor Spread Through Air Spaces or STAS, the Prognostic Significance of Grading in Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. So it's published in Modern Pathology. And the aim of their article was to investigate the association of the extent of STAS using a two-tiered grading system with clinical pathologic features as well as patient outcomes in surgically resected cases of non-small cell lung cancer. And so for their methodology, they reviewed nearly 3,000 pathology reports of surgically resected lung cancers from a time period of 2011 to 2018 at a single academic institution in Korea. And they identified nearly 2,000 cases of non-small cell lung cancers. The breakdown of that was 1,544 adenocarcinomas and 325 squamous cell carcinomas. Notably, they excluded neuroendocrine neoplasm, other malignancies, as well as patients who had received neoadjuvant therapies. So their definition of STAS for this paper and what they called in their pathology reports as erogenous spread was micropapillary or solid clusters or single tumor cells that were free floating within air spaces beyond the edge of the tumor. And they excluded some artifacts, which they described as tumor clusters with jagged edges, which could represent the blade of the knife, linear strips of tumor cells, which had lifted off of the alveolar walls, and also isolated clusters of tumor cells that were found at a far distance, rather than spreading in a continuous fashion from the edge of the tumor. So this is figure one from their paper, and it nicely illustrates their two-tiered grading system. And one of the strengths of their paper was that this has been performed on an ongoing or prospective basis at their institution since 2011 by a single academic pulmonary pathologist. So grade one is the area between the tumor and this dotted black line, and that is a distance of less than 2,500 micrometers, or the equivalent of 1/10x objective field. And then grade two is everything outside or further away than that dotted black line. So moving on to their results, table one summarizes the clinical pathologic characteristics for all of their cases of non-small cell lung cancers. And they found STAS in 41% of cases, 24% were graded as STAS 1 and 17% as STAS 2. And then that was broken down into adenocarcinoma, which had STAS in 44% of cases, 25% were STAS 1 and 19% were STAS 2. And then squamous cell carcinoma, where a lower percentage, 25% had STAS, 19% were STAS 1 and 5.5% were STAS 2. And they noted that the presence and grade of STAS was associated with adenocarcinoma histology, as well as several factors that are associated with more aggressive disease like pleural invasion, lymphovascular invasion, necrosis, higher pathologic stage, as well as lobectomy or more radical resection in comparison to a limited wedge resection. They found no differences in clinical variables that they looked at, like sex, age, and smoking, and no difference in the surgical approach, vets versus open, which might be important if you're thinking about mechanical factors that could be contributing to this phenomenon of STAS. Table two summarizes clinical pathologic characteristics for their adenocarcinoma cases. And notable points from that table are that they found that the presence and grade of STAS were associated with the predominant growth pattern. So the strongest association, not surprisingly, because this has been described before, was with the micropapillary pattern, and then in decreasing order, solid, papillary, acinar, and lipidic patterns. They found that the presence of micropapillary pattern was associated STAS with STAS regardless of the amount of micropapillary that was present. So it could be important to mention micropapillary, no matter how much of it is there. And then STAS was interestingly found more often in EGFR wild type tumors, although that wasn't associated with grade of STAS. Moving on to their survival analysis, figure two shows Kaplan-Meier curves for all of their adenocarcinoma cases, and they found that the grade of STAS was associated with decreased recurrence-free survival, overall survival, and lung cancer-specific survival. So I'm just highlighting part A from that figure. This is the five-year recurrence-free survival, and the patients have been stratified by the grade of STAS. So the black line is no STAS, and at 5 years, they have a 91.8% recurrence-free survival. The green line is STAS 1, 79%, and then STAS 2, which falls to 60.5%. And that gave hazard ratios for STAS 1 of 2.8 and for STAS 2 of 6. And they didn't find any differences in survival for their squamous cell carcinoma group. So then they went on to do a subgroup survival analysis looking at just their stage 1A non-mucinous adenocarcinomas. And figure three shows that the grade of STAS was associated with decreased recurrence-free survival and lung cancer-specific survival in this group, regardless of the extent of resection. And again, I'm showing here just the five-year recurrence-free survival. And we have the black line as no STAS. This is for limited resection. Green is STAS 1, and then quite a drop in the recurrence-free survival for STAS 2. That was similar for the radical resection group. They went on to do univariate and multivariate analyses using Cox regression, and they included in their model multiple variables in addition to presence of STAS and STAS grade. They also included age, sex, smoking, micropapillary, vascular, and lymphatic invasion, necrosis, margin status, and pathologic stage, which they subdivided into T1A, B, and C. And so in table three, their model for the univariate and multivariate analysis was looking at recurrence-free survival in stage 1A non-mucinous adenocarcinoma according to the extent of resection. And they found in this model that STAS2 was an independent risk factor for recurrence-free survival, regardless of the extent of resection. So that was true both in the wedge and the lobectomies. However, STAS1 had no bearing on the recurrence-free survival in this model. Table four shows a different model, which is looking at recurrence-free survival, overall survival, and the lung cancer-specific survival, again, in these stage 1A non-mucinous adenocarcinomas. And in this model, they found that STAS2 was an independent risk factor for recurrence-free survival, as well as lung cancer-specific survival. They found that STAS1 was an independent risk factor for recurrence-free survival only. Also, vascular invasion was an independent risk factor for recurrence-free survival, and age, not surprisingly, and then also presence of necrosis were independent risk factors for overall survival. So the take-home message that the authors really stressed in their discussion for this paper was that STAS2 was an independent poor prognostic factor in low-stage non-mucinous adenocarcinoma, regardless of the extent of resection. And so they suggested that in this context, it might be useful to include information about the presence and grade of STAS in pathology reports. However, they added that clearly more studies are needed so that we have a more unanimous consensus on how grading would be defined. And I'd like to open it up to any discussion or questions.
This is Andra. So I have a question regarding mucinous adenocarcinomas. They have been known to produce an erogenous spread for a long time, way before we have been talking about STAS. So my question is it analyzed in this paper or?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's not in the main text of their paper, and they specifically look in their subgroup analysis at their low stage non-mucinous adenocarcinomas. So they must have been thinking about it. No, that's not discussed in the main body of the text. It could be in the supplementary. I'm not sure, but I would expect it to show similar findings of more STAS.
So it's interesting, they didn't find anything for squamous cell carcinoma, if I understood that correct. Is it, did they have any trends? Is it maybe because they had too few cases, although I think the case number was pretty good, or is it just because there is no, really nothing they could tease out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they had, I guess their 325 cases had something like, what was it, 25% of that. So they have a fair number of cases that had stas, but it wasn't enough to show a survival difference or a recurrence-free survival difference. So it may have been a bit of a numbers issue. They actually don't present a figure for their survival curve, so I don't know how good they looked for the squamous cell group. But yeah, I mean, certainly it is known that compared to adenocarcinoma previously, that they have less stas. But yeah, I guess I would have thought that it would have correlated with survival, but maybe they need bigger numbers.
Thank you.
This is Andreas again. I'm sorry to return back to mucinous, but I'm wondering what the group does about stas in mucinous adenocarcinomas. Do you report it? Do you not report it?
Do you mean invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma or a discrete tumor that has mucinous differentiation? I assume you're talking about invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma.
They say that non-invasive mucinous adenocarcinomas are so rare that for practical purposes they don't even exist. But
no, but there's plenty of solid tumors that are reasonably discrete that have mucinous differentiation and make mucinous that are not invasive mucinous. So
I'm talking about invasive mucinous carcinoma as a variant of adenocarcinoma. Do you report stas in those cases?
By definition, stas has to be beyond the limits of the tumor. If your tumor has no limits, then it's pretty hard to report stas.
So if I understand this correctly, then there is no reason to talk about stas in mucinous, right?
In invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma, Andras, the specific subset that's mnemonic. Right? That's what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't do it.
So then stas should be defined as non-mucinous adenocarcinoma in the invasive sense, right?
And I think Tom is making a good point because if you have a mnemonic form where your most of your lobe or the tumor, you can't really draw a line around the tumor because it's all these spread areas, it's hard to kind of talk about stas, although you could argue that the entire tumor is kind of growing in a stas way.
That's exactly my point is. So we should define stas as a tumor the tumor cells or tumor clusters beyond the edge of the tumor in a non-mucinous adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma.
No, Andras, my point is that there are localized tumors that do have stas, that do have mucinous differentiation, but they're the ones that are reasonably discrete. And the invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma is only one subset of those tumors in the lung that have mucinous differentiation. In my experience, mucinous differentiation is pretty common. You know, at least a focal change.
I think we all agree.
I have a question just to, for the group. I know we don't at Michigan, but is anyone kind of quantifying the extent of stas when they're reporting it in their reports routinely?
No, but I do like the idea of this grading system because I think it's, you know, I had a case recently where is this stas or not? I did a level and it was clearly just a connected part of, part of the tumor. So it was pretty focal. So I kind of like, if we're going to adopt this, that we have some grade, and it seems like the more you you know, the more of it and the further away it is, the more it probably means, because I think there are iffy cases, but I don't see it, maybe it's because of me, near as often as they report. I mean, this is a pretty high, I don't know how it compares to some of the other studies, because I haven't really, I haven't kept up on the finer points of STAS, but it seems like a pretty high percentage of cases.
Yeah, I think part of that relates to their definition of STAS 1, which is including everything, even one alveolar space away from the tumor, as long as it's less than the 2,500 micrometers. But how relevant that is, I think you make a good point.
Great. Well, that was great conversation around that, and really good job presenting, Rachel. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move on to the second article for discussion. This is a paper out of histopathology entitled Progression of Fibrosing Diffuse Alveolar Damage in a Series of 30 Minimally Invasive Autopsies with COVID-19 Pneumonia in Wuhan, China. So this is a group of pathologists in Wuhan, and Dr. Travis is on this paper as well. So I think that kind of their reason for doing this, they say, is that virtually all previous studies detail the acute and organizing phases of DAD, mainly because COVID tends to be a rapidly progressive to death. And there's interest in looking at patients with prolonged clinical course. And since we don't really know how these patients are going to behave clinically, that autopsy studies are our best surrogate at this time. So their purpose is to document the evolution of DAD in patients that die of COVID-19 pneumonia and correlate the progression to fibrosing DAD with patient age, duration of clinical course, hospitalization, and mechanical ventilation. So what they did was they looked at consecutively reviewed lung tissue obtained from minimally invasive autopsies, and they looked at the medical records as well from those autopsies performed at a hospital in Wuhan, China, in patients that tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 or had positive antibody tests prior to death. The minimally invasive autopsies were performed by ultrasound-guided core needle biopsies that were performed on the bilateral lungs, and they obtained at least 4 or 5 tissue samples. The slides were reviewed by 3 pathologists, and DAD was classified as acute, organizing, or fibrosing based upon the prominent component and other pathologic findings, such as the presence of acute bronchopneumonia. And kind of they detail what they looked at in the supplemental table 1. I yesterday added, if you downloaded all of the articles before yesterday, I actually added yesterday the supplementary information, the supplementary table 1, into our shared folder. And that's what I'll be referring to at a couple points during this summary. So what they had in their cohort were 30 patients with COVID-19 who underwent minimally invasive autopsy over the course of February and March 2020, so a fairly short time frame. They obtained all of this autopsy material. Table 1, which is on page 545 of the manuscript, details the clinical characteristics, duration of illness, hospitalization, treatments, if they had any positive cultures other than their COVID-19 tests, and their days of ventilatory support. They also list there the number of tissue cores for each patient. A couple points that I drew out from this: the mean age of the patients was 69 years old, but a broad age range from 39 to 91 years old. The majority of patients were male, 20 males, 10 females, and most patients had at least one significant underlying illness, for which hypertension was the most common, seen in 11 patients. 8 patients had malignancy, 5 had coronary artery disease, and notably only one was known to have respiratory disease prior to death, and they were said to have COPD and asthma. So CT chests were not readily available in most of the patients. They only have a CT chest for one patient. That's reported in their supplemental information. I kind of wish I knew which patient it was. They don't provide that, but they do say it's one of the patients with fibrosing DAD. Kind of descriptively, it sounds like the CT findings may have resembled UIP with reticulations, lower lobe traction bronchiectasis, and I believe cystic or honeycomb change. But we don't know how old that patient is or anything else about them. So moving on to what they found when looking at the histology. Really, a lot of this next portion is from supplementary table one, if you want to look at that in detail. So DAD was diagnosed in 28 of the 30 cases, and DAD was attributed as the cause of death in those patients. Two patients had acute bronchopneumonia and gastric cancer, and those were determined to be the cause of death in those patients. Of the DAD cases, most cases showed multiple patterns, multiple overlapping, which is not surprising. And the predominant patterns were as follows. They found acute DAD characterized by the presence of hyaline membranes being the predominant pattern in 9 cases. Organizing DAD that is predominated by fibromyxoid plugs in 7 cases, and fibrosing DAD in 12 cases. And kind of, if you refer to figure 2 for the pattern of fibrosis, to my eye, it seems to resemble somewhat NSIP-like fibrosis in at least what's represented there and described in the text. Table 2 details the clinical correlations with the predominant DAD patterns. I thought this was really interesting. So fibrosing DAD patients on average were younger and ventilated longer than patients with acute or organizing DAD. So that's they age 64 years in fibrosing DAD versus in both acute and organizing, the average age was 77 years of age. Their ventilator days were about a week longer than those patients with just acute or organizing DAD. In both of those categories, ventilator days were at 20 as compared to 28 days in fibrosing DAD. Interestingly, the days of illness and the days of hospitalization were actually longest in those cases of organizing DAD. But if you group together organizing and fibrosing DAD, overall, they were sick longer and hospitalized longer than acute DAD. So I think for me, the take-home findings were that patients with prolonged hospitalization and ventilation who die of COVID-19 related disease may develop fibrosing DAD that is morphologically characterized by diffuse alveolar septal thickening, by collagenous fibrosis. And of course, this begs the question, at least for me it did, will we see an increase in fibrosing lung disease as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic? I think that some of the limitations of this study, which they have acknowledged here, are how this relates to functional impairment. Of course, we can't determine from this autopsy study. So that's something that remains to be seen in survivors. And then for me, at least, I think that CT findings would have been helpful to the if they were available, just in better understanding the extent of the disease. Certainly, it sounds like they took a number of cores, and if the fibrosing pattern was predominant, I would assume that that means in probably greater than 3 tissue cores, that was the predominant pattern, but I think that would have been helpful in understanding if these patients really had diffuse parenchymal lung disease. So that's all I have on this very interesting study, if anyone has any comments.
Just a question. About,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, did they have informed consent for this? This is kind of a macabre study.
I think that they did. They from the patient families. Consent obtained from patient families.
Then you wonder why they didn't do a full autopsy.
Mm-hmm. I know. I think that they were worried about, they mentioned in here that they were worried about aerosolization. So that's why they were doing this. This was kind of towards the beginning of the pandemic. Maybe had this been done later, they would have felt more comfortable.
This is Andras. We recently had a transplantation for fibrosing DED in a COVID patient.
Really?
I'm wondering whether you guys had any cases. Maybe I think we had one or two of those transplants. If you have similar cases, we may combine our efforts and publish them together.
So we didn't yet, but I know there are some case reports out there, and I think there is even a case series of 12 cases where they transplanted COVID patients and looked at the explants. It's quite interesting. They had some similar findings. And we are actually currently getting together our cases, not the explants, but like patients who died later of COVID, and it's really interesting to see a lot of fibrosing disease, kind of cicatricial organizing pneumonia, those things.
So no COVID transplants in the group?
Not at Michigan, not that I'm aware of.
I've seen a couple in consultation from, I think they made the news about, I think from UT. It's one of the Texas hospitals. I forget exactly where. I can track them down if you wanted.
Were those cases NSIP, like the fibrosis?
Yeah, I mean, NSIP and fibrosing DEDs is very difficult to separate. I think actually Katzenstein mentioned that in her original paper of NSIP.
Correct. Cool.
The only way to separate the two is really to have some, either the history or seeing some acute component. And actually, even though our recent case had like a 3 months history, I think he was a 55-year-old male diagnosed with COVID in January and had a transplant in April. He still had an acute component as well.
I'm just curious, do you know
acute how DAD component in addition to the fibrosing one?
What were you going to ask?
Oh, I was just wondering, Andras, do you know how long that patient was on the transplant list? Because what I saw from the other case studies also, they were very short on the transplant list, like within 6 days, 5 to 6 days.
I think ours was on the transplant list for 4 days, actually. He was on the ECMO and on the transplant list.
Well, thank you for sharing. I'll go on quickly to these last two that are shorter summaries, and I will cut to the chase when talking about these cases. So the next one we have is from CHEST. This was the title is Excellent Prognosis of Patients with Invasive Lung Adenocarcinomas During Surgery Misdiagnosed as Atypical Adenomatous Hyperplasia Adenocarcinoma in situ or minimally invasive adenocarcinoma by frozen section. This study is out of Shanghai, China, and 9 of the authors are clinicians. Only one is a pathologist. And this is certainly, you know, it's in CHEST, and I think it's a clinically oriented perspective. I think the title, you know, I thought misdiagnosis was a little harsh. At any rate, moving on. So this study presumes that frozen sections are being used for selection of patients for limited resection. I'll tell you here at Michigan, fortunately for me, this is not used in intraoperatively that frequently. I think in the past 7 years, I've maybe been asked a handful of times whether or not the lesion is invasive or not. And our surgeons tend to go in knowing, you know, regardless of if they get a malignant diagnosis, if the patient is a candidate for a lobectomy, they're going to perform it, or if they're not due to functional impairment, regardless, they're just going to do a wedge or a segmentectomy. So in that regard, I feel lucky. But these authors wanted to investigate the prognosis of patients who undergo sublobar resection, that is wedge resection or segmentectomy, for intraoperatively diagnosed AAH, AIS, or MIA, who are later reclassified as having invasive adenocarcinoma in their final pathology reports. So they retrospectively reviewed the clinical characteristics, CT scans, tumor characteristics, and outcomes of patients who underwent frozen section and surgical resection for lung nodules between January 2012 and December 2018. Their inclusion criteria, perhaps not surprisingly, as implied by the title and purpose, is a diagnosis of primary lung adenocarcinoma, intraoperative frozen sections diagnosed as AAH, AIS, or MIA, and then for whom a subtotal resection was performed. I thought their frozen section, kind of their method, was interesting in that they sample one slice from the largest diameter of tumor. That doesn't surprise me so much, but their frozen sections are interpreted by two pathologists at the time. And if there's disagreement, a third pathologist is involved. So up to three pathologists looking at a frozen section to make this determination. So they had 3,000 cases that met, over 3,000 cases that met inclusion criteria. 192, or about 6% of which had discrepancies between frozen section and the final pathology. And I thought that was quite good for something that I think has quite a bit of inter-observer agreement. But if they're being so rigorous in their frozen section diagnosis, perhaps I shouldn't be surprised. I think that, not surprisingly, is that the vast majority of cases in which there was a discrepancy were really those that were diagnosed as minimally invasive adenocarcinoma on frozen section. So really that invasive focus at frozen section was measured as something greater at the time of final pathology. Adenocarcinoma in situ and AAH comprise a small proportion of cases. Over 98% of the cases were diagnosed as invasive lipidic, acinar, or papillary predominant on final pathology. Kind of the final path is detailed in Table 2 if you want to look at that. There was one case that was solid and one that was mucinous. I wonder, you know, it's not provided, but I wonder how additional sections changed the diagnoses in these cases. So table one details the pathologic staging related data. I thought it was interesting that they kind of, their cutoff was 2 centimeters, and I wondered how many cases were over 3 centimeters.
I can take you.
Presumably none of them were, but they had five cases that were over 2 centimeters. None of the cases had lymph node disease, and all of the patients had 5-year recurrence-free and overall survival. So to make this short and sweet, kind of the take-home message is that if you're asked to differentiate between these entities on frozen section, these minimally invasive or in situ lesions, and then it's later discovered to be an invasive adenocarcinoma, don't try not to feel too bad, because patients with small lung cancers, that is 2 centimeters or less, almost certainly do well. And I don't know how frequently. I think just my question is, are you guys being regularly asked to do this at frozen section?
No.
I think the question is whether the surgeon would do anything differently.
Well, at this
at your institution.
Yeah, at this
because
institution.
Because I think here at Mayo Clinic in Florida, I think they decide what kind of surgery the patient is going to have before the surgery begins.
Yep. same at Michigan. Yeah. So we're all lucky in this regard.
Yeah, it's like you, Christine. Once in a while, I've gotten a request, but it's kind of more unusual than common.
How about 3,000 cases of 2-centimeter or smaller tumors over a 6-year period? That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, the numbers are astounding.
Sleeping giant is waking.
All right. Let's see. There's one comment. I wouldn't diagnose MIA on represented frozen sections to begin with. Understood in the comment. So last but not least, I'll be very brief in our final summary, which is in the American Journal of Surgical Pathology, looking at trichrome and alcyon blue stains to distinguish between light chain deposition for an amyloid in the lung. And I think this is a really practical question, and that's why I liked this paper, at least for places such as Michigan, where we don't have or we don't perform mass spec or immunofluorescence for light chain identification or confirmation. Really, those cases, I think, would be sent to Mayo. But I think it's a practical question that, you know, we get these questions either in-house or in consult cases. It's a negative Congo red, and you don't really have positive stains to hang your hat on for light chain deposition. So what this group really set out to do was evaluate the use of trichrome and alcyon blue stains to distinguish pulmonary light chain deposition disease from amyloid. That was the primary aim. And then the secondary aim was to assess the presence of lymphoid or plasma cell neoplasms occurring in association with light chain deposition disease. So the diagnostic algorithm is detailed in figure one, which kind of shows the selection and of these cases and diagnosis as light chain deposition. There were also 10 cases of amyloid used as control. There were 11 cases identified during the time period. Four of these were identified retrospectively. I suspect that maybe this was for maybe a tumor board or in consultation. They weren't originally diagnosed as having light chain deposition, but then later diagnosed as having it. Two of these were lung cancer cases with amorphous deposits that were Congo red negative. One was interpreted initially as a lung infarct, and then a third case was hyalinizing fibrosis in a lung explant. That's a patient that expired, and I think that's what was being referred to in the introduction and why this question even came up to these investigators. So radiographically, most of these patients had nodules, though a subset had cystic lung disease. The pathologic assessment showed that light chain deposition had negative Congo red, not surprisingly, but bright red staining on trichrome and a salmon pink color on alcyon blue staining. Amyloid in contrast was, of course, Congo red positive, trichrome blue gray, and alcyon blue green. All of the cases of light chain deposition were associated with a lymphoproliferative disorder, for which malt lymphoma was with extensive plasmacytic differentiation was the most common finding. So just the take-home message here was this combination of stains was helpful in distinguishing non-amyloid light chain deposition from amyloid. So it'd be particularly useful in centers that don't have the confirmatory immunofluorescence or mass spec for this diagnosis. So I thought this was really practical, and thank you for publishing it, because I think that a couple of the authors are on this call.
I assume most of these cases were systemic as opposed to localized light chain deposition.
I would need to look back. I think that most of them presented as nodules, so were localized. Is that correct?
Did these patients have a history of some kind of plasma cell disorder?
Only one was diagnosed with multiple myeloma.
That's surprising because localized light chain deposition is not common.
I don't remember, Andras, I was part of this, as was Tom, and I cannot recall how many of them were adequately characterized clinically to be able to distinguish a more systemic process from a localized process.
Thanks.
The one thing I think was helpful that I don't remember if it really adequately conveyed in the paper or not, but I would offer it to the group just as an FYI. The bright Fryer engine red staining that we saw with many of the trichrome stained cases, which was highlighted in the paper, which I assume would be the go-to stain that most people would go to if they didn't have access to sulfated Alschen blue stains like we do, that bright red staining is not always uniformly present throughout the light chain deposits. So sometimes it's a little darker and more admixed with bluish purple. So particularly in the small biopsy setting, be careful. Red is helpful, but absence of red or kind of weak or inadequate red is not necessarily indicative that it is not light chain. But we found it to be quite helpful. We've started using it down in Arizona in these cases and the group, and we found it to be quite helpful and quite predictive of light chain in the right setting.
Yeah, that's why I really enjoyed it. Our Congo red isn't that great sometimes, so I was always using a trichrome as a complement to it, but I have to admit, I don't think I'd applied it to any cases that ended up being light chain. So this is something for me to look for.
One other piece of info, if you ever do send stuff to Rochester, and I know a lot of people do because it's one of the few places, you know, where mass spec is done, make sure that you notify, write somewhere on the paperwork that you're looking for light chain. Because if the tech, you know, or whoever is circling the area of the Congo red, I mean, if the Congo red is negative, they are not going to do mass spec unless you say you're specifically looking for light chain. So just a little tidbit, because otherwise you'll get it back. They won't have done it. So, you know, I think having this confirmatory stain really can help you, you know, make sure that you say, yeah, we're really looking for light chain. We need you to do this, even though it's going to be Congo red negative.
That's really helpful to know, because I know that we have cases from Michigan sent up to you guys. So. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice job.
Nice journal club.